Cologne in the 1250s. There was a lot of unrest in the city in the middle of the 13th century. The richest citizens of the city had twice come into armed conflict with the city's ruler, the Archbishop of Cologne. Both times were bloody, and was only with the greatest effort that they managed to settle the conflict with the mediation of Albertus Magnus. In 1259, 1 year after the last conflict, Cologne's political landscape continued to be characterized by deep social tensions. Many people are excluded from the city government, especially the less privileged classes, but also large sections of the middle class consisting of small traders and craftsmen. The influential Riecherzech, the Brotherhood of the Rich, made up of the city's wealthy families, represented only a small proportion of the wealthy population, but nevertheless dominated political power, and while it was still permeable in the 12th century, it increasingly isolates itself from the rest of the population and prefers to keep to itself. The Riecherzeche began to see themselves as the city nobility, allegedly with ancestors going way back to Cologne's Roman period. What nonsense, given that many of these families had themselves only immigrated to Cologne a few generations ago. Cologne in the year 1259. As I said, many inhabitants are excluded from the bourgeois city regiment. Only a few families united in the Riecherzeche can. Nevertheless, they only made up a tiny proportion of the rest of the city's population, even of the wealthy inhabitants of Cologne. And as I said, the year is now 1259, 1 year after the great arbitration, which we covered in the last episode. And you remember, one person was not at all happy with the results, or rather the compromises that had been reached, our city lord, Archbishop Konrad von Hochstaden. Despite several military victories, he had not achieved what he wanted, regaining absolute control over the city of Cologne. Of course, Konrad von Hochstaden was not unaware of the dissatisfaction among some citizens of Cologne, and here he saw an opportunity to exploit this for his own political advantage. And what the Archbishop of Cologne set in motion here in 1259 was, as the historian Hugo Stehkämper once summarized, a revolution from above. Let's dive into it right after the intro. If you read the title for this episode, you might be confused. Why is this about domestic conflicts again and not about the staple rights? You'll soon find out what the staple rights, the Stapelrecht in German, is. It was like a money printing machine for Cologne for centuries to come. The granting of the Stapelrecht, the staple rights, by the city's ruler Konrad von Hochstaden in 1259 is well known to many Cologne residents. However, the fact that this was accompanied by major political upheaval is less well known. That is why we will look also into this first. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. If you wanted to disempower the city's most powerful bourgeois families, you could not simply proceed by force, as many archbishops had already bitterly learned as Cologne's city ruler. Perhaps the field of the previously unified front of the Riecherzeche could be thinned out beforehand, and Konrad made a poisoned offer. The archbishop first offered the wealthiest citizens of Cologne economic advantages and prosperity, especially money and goods, in return for which they were to give him back some of their political power. In other words, they were to give up positions in the collegiate of jurors, for example, and submit themselves and their family members as his own subjects. However, the archbishop was not successful with this. The families, the patricians, rejected the offer. Who was surprised? They were already rich, so why trade freedom for more wealth? And here it comes. This is exactly what Konrad von Hochstaden, the Archbishop of Cologne, was counting on. He now set his planned maneuvers into motion. The Archbishop immediately sought out his new allies, among the citizens of Cologne, above all the craftsmen, weavers, and those responsible in the parishes, some of whom already played a role in the city council, the new city council, which was still a very young institution in Cologne. These citizens, who were often wealthy but marginalized in terms of power politics, formed a new alliance with the archbishop against the patricians, a so-called League of the Discontented, so to speak, an alliance against the power of the few patrician families. Here in 1259, 1 year after the proclamation of the Great Arbitration, Conrad cancels the Great Arbitration, the agreement between himself and the rich citizens of Cologne. This was because he had the majority of the citizens behind him with his League of the Discontented. The behavior here is rude and sometimes violent, but how does the city ruler justify this? By invoking the Great Arbitration that he's going to cancel. Plot twist. The Great Arbitration had largely confirmed previously the power of the Richterzech in Cologne as far as the co-rule of the rich citizens in the city was concerned. However, the arbitrator Albertus Magnus had given the archbishop quasi-quality management over the city's ruling bodies with the aim of appeasing both parties. The archbishop was to intervene if the patrician families did not behave decently in the exercise of their power over the city. According to the Great Arbitration, the archbishop was explicitly authorized to redress grievances in the city. The thing is, who decided when such abuses existed in the city? Who made the decision about that? Well, that's the point. It was within the archbishop's own discretionary powers. A dangerous loophole to throw political power in Cologne overboard. And Conrad used this backdoor, this loophole, immediately. The archbishop set in motion a veritable step-by-step plan to disempower the previous office holders in the Cologne citizenry among the patrician families. Firstly, he struck at the point that had originally started all the disputes in 1252. The control of when, how, and how many coins were to be struck was to return entirely to him, the archbishop. On 24th of March 1259, shortly after the richest families in the cities had rejected his offer of submission, Conrad therefore announced the dismissal of the minting comrades. This was the body that minted the money in Cologne, but had some kind of autonomous status in that time. In doing so, the archbishop utilized the backdoor already explained, which the Great Arbitration had granted him a year earlier. The archbishop attested to corruption and misconduct on the part of the minting cooperative. According to the Great Arbitrator, it was up to him to remedy these abuses and crack down on them. Most of the mint mates were removed from office, and Conrad replaced them with new mint mates who were completely loyal to him now. The new people were actually recruited from his alliance, his League of Discontent that Conrad had formed with the craftsmen, small merchants, and with members of the parishes in the city. Perhaps some members of the Collegiate of Magistrates of the Jurors had hoped that the supreme lord of the city had thus been politically saturated. After all, he had always been interested in money which was always in short supply for an archbishop, duke and elector at the same time, but that was not the case. Conrad von Hochstein wanted to completely turn the clock back. The next step followed a month later, on 17th April 1259. Now the archbishop complained that the Collegiate of Magistrates, the Collegiate of Jurors, was full of those who were guilty of bribery, corruption, robbery and extortion against the ordinary people in the city. Corruption was rampant among the magistrates, including in court judgments and the election of new magistrates. And between you and me, I believe the archbishop was certainly not even lying with that accusations. Corruption and nepotism were probably really rampant in the committee. How else could the archbishop have forged a broad alliance of discontent among the town's population so quickly? The magistrates, once appointed by the archbishop as a body to support the archbishop in court, had risen to become powerful and municipal officials. Although they still swore an oath to the archbishop as lord of the city, They had long been traveling with their own agenda. Conrad, therefore, cracked down here too. The archbishop dismissed 16 of the 25 magistrates. He had the deposed magistrates imprisoned or banished from the city, and they were also excluded from the Richard Zeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich. Do we know who was ostracized here? Mainly the patrician members, so those from the few richest families in Cologne. Five members of the Mühlengasse family, already well known from an earlier podcast episode. Two more men from the Lindgasse family. Of course, the Kleingedanks, who had been at odds with the archbishop the year before, also had to pay the price. Four magistrates from the Kleingedank family were dismissed from office, in addition to Birkelin and two Harderfust members as well. However, it was also interesting to note which of the other nine magistrates did not lose their position in the College of Magistrates. Above all, not a single member of the Oberstolzen family fell out of favor with the archbishop. Had the Oberstolzens negotiated a deal with the city lord beforehand? Good question, I don't know. The previous admission procedure was also radically reorganized in that collegiate of magistrates. Previously, the magistrates decide among themselves who they would elect to their midst when one of the 25 places became vacant, usually due to the death of a previous magistrate. Conrad now decided directly who became a magistrate and who did not. The archbishop immediately filled the 16 vacant posts with new men, and what a wonder, the new magistrates were non-patricians, and the majority were craftsmen and no longer rich long-distance traders as before. So he recruited them from his alliance of the discontented, which was led by him. Formally, the archbishop was careful not to act alone in order to avoid the accusation of tyranny. He had the disempowerment of the 16 old patrician magistrates confirmed and witnessed by the council, brotherhoods, the guilds, and the people of the municipality and the entirety of the citizens, as Gottfried Hagen's Rhine Chronicle of the City of Cologne lists. It shows the allies on the side of Conrad, his alliance of the discontented. The new magistrates, who were appointed by the archbishop, became overzealous in their declarations of loyalty to Conrad and urged the city lord to have the deposed magistrates executed. But Conrad did not allow this. On the contrary, he allowed almost all the deposed, imprisoned patrician magistrates to escape from the city and go into exile. As already mentioned, the archbishop did not want to be seen as a tyrant and certainly did not want to antagonize other patrician families who were still in the city or had not been targeted by the political purges yet. The Archbishop of Cologne, Konrad von Hochstahl, he now had done it. He had regained control over the right to mint coins and brought the College of Magistrates into line, and thus put an end to the increasingly willful politics of the citizens of Cologne. All this through a radical exchange of personnel at both institutions. All under the pretense of standing up for the poorest classes, such as the middle classes. Ultimately, of course, it was also about his own power. The supreme lord of the city invoked the legal means to which he was entitled, but contemporary witnesses, like chronicler, clergyman, and Cologne resident Gottfried Hagen, saw this as a breach of the law and called these new magistrates, quote, donkeys, because they were not noble merchants and were blindly obedient to their patron, Archbishop Conrad. In the summer of 1259, Conrad is at the height of his power in the exercise of city rule. What sounds like a coup to us, Conrad saw as perfectly legitimate. Great arbitration had given him the task of redressing grievances in the city, and he had now done so. But what does all this have to do with the staple right, a privilege that should make Cologne incredibly rich as a city? Thank you for listening up to this point, because what has come before was the basis for why the archbishop deigned to grant such an extensive privilege in the first place, and we will get to that now. So, let's finally get to the staple right. What is the staple right anyway? The Stapelrecht in German, which was valid in Cologne until the 19th century, is a compulsory right for merchants traveling through. And, on the other hand, was a trading privilege for the city or the market town that possessed it. It said, in general terms, that a foreign trader traveling through a place must stay there for a certain period of time. He had to take a break and unload, weigh, measure or evaluate his goods there and then even offer them for sale within a certain period of time. In Cologne, it was 3 days, as far as the sales window was concerned, and only for people living in Cologne. It meant an exclusive right of first refusal for all Cologne residents. Only then were the out-of-town traders allowed to pack up their goods, load them up and travel on. Furthermore, it was forbidden for foreign merchants in Cologne to trade with each other. If a Fleming wanted to sell something to a Hungarian, the farmer had to sell it first to a Cologne merchant, who was then allowed to sell it to the Hungarian. The Cologne merchants thus also became middlemen. In addition to all the other economic advantages that the rights of first refusal already brought with it, the staple right. Too complex or confusing for you? Here's an example. A Fleming passes Cologne on his way to Frankfurt. He has to stop in the city with his goods. He pays taxes and duties here. He has now to unload his goods, in this case probably cloth and textiles. City officials inspected, measured, or weighed the goods and issued a certificate of quality. The Flemish merchant also paid for this. Some might think this was a harassment, yeah, maybe, but those who survived the strict inspection in Cologne and received a corresponding seal of quality had a great sales argument for increasing the price of their goods elsewhere. The so-called Kölner Brand was particularly sought after for herring, the fish. After all, it was regarded as the seal of quality in the Middle Ages. Brand because the seal of quality was branded on the barrels in which the herring fish was stored. But it could also work the other way around. If the quality was poor, the city of Cologne reserved the right to burn or destroy the goods without paying compensation. Sounds extreme, but even today's custom authorities are authorized to do this in certain cases. Once the quality inspection was over, the Flemish merchant was not allowed to leave the city. He now had to offer his unloaded goods for sale for 3 days, but as I said, only to Cologne residents and not to other merchants traveling through. Once the 3 days were over, the Flemish merchant was allowed to move on. Of course, he was free to do further business in Cologne as well, then also to other local merchants traveling through. So you see, the staple right was a very powerful instrument in Cologne. Attempts to establish and enforce the staple right in Cologne date back to the 12th century. The people of Cologne insisted on it and tried to enforce it again and again, but they were never able to really enforce it officially until now. On 7th May 1259, just a few weeks after Conrad had, well, reorganized the collegiate of magistrates according to his will, Conrad von Hochstaben confirmed that the city of Cologne held and was allowed to implement the Stapelrecht, the staple right. Conrad von Hochstaben was therefore not granting a new right, but rather making a previously semi-legal and economic customary right of the city of Cologne legal as the supreme city ruler of Cologne. However, it was now official, and Cologne would ensure that this privilege was strictly enforced for centuries to come. This made Conrad popular with everyone living in the city of Cologne, even with the patricians that were still there. As middlemen, they were now able to earn a golden nose, as we say in German, so to earn a buck in the city, as traveling merchants were only allowed to trade with Cologne merchants in the city according to the staple right. But broad sections of Cologne also profited from this. Traveling merchants naturally also left a lot of money in the city if they had to spend several days in Cologne, at the barbers, in the tavern, with city officials, at masses in church, with local merchants in general, with harbor workers who loaded and unloaded their goods, and even with ruffles or beggars in the city. With the staple right, Conrad von Hochstaben removed another potential source of conflict that had previously threatened his rule, for one of the complaints of the citizens in the Great Arbitration had been that he, the Archbishop, had previously granted foreign merchants free passage through Cologne, both on the Rhine and by land. The city, and therefore the people of Cologne, had lost a lot of money in their eyes and wealth as a result. Even though it has not yet been written down anywhere, there had probably already been developments to see this as an ancient right of the city of Cologne to tax and influence passing trade, and yeah, the archbishop complied with the city's request in the summer of 1259 and issued Cologne with a document to this effect. Shall we read the document a little bit? Of course, translated from Latin into English. Quote, and be aware, medieval documents have a lot of phrases in it, but let's continue. Quote, Conrad, by the grace of God, Archbishop of the Holy Church of Cologne, Arch-Chancellor of the Empire in Italy, to all who will take note of the foregoing and perpetual memory of the facts. Because we endeavor in our days to cherish the transitionary peace in the world, according to our powers, we and the other zealots, for what is so good, may hope for the peace of eternity. Moreover, we have realized that the more we are strengthened before the rest by the power of divine providence and the concession of grace, the more we are acknowledged to hold, with the crozier, the power of temporal authority, and the sword in view of the two ducats of our church. This double rule, both with the crozier and with the sword, we believe to be appropriate and rightful when we hold out the prospect to those near and far, to natives and strangers, and diligently direct parts of our attention to ensuring that they may possess theirs in peace, and that neither these nor those may overstep the bounds or limits of their jurisdiction. Since, in the arbitration between us and our church, on the one hand, and our faithful, the judges, magistrates, and all citizens of Cologne, on the other hand, concerning our rights by the honorable man and beloved in Christ, and now he just counts up several citizen names, blah, 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 under our seal this year and signed by all parties, it is clearly stipulated that foreign merchants who come to Cologne and assemble there with the intention of trading shall not be permitted to do so. The city of Cologne has no intention of overstepping the boundaries that were established in the old days, but in accordance with the old custom, both our side and the citizens of Cologne should observe them unwaveringly, because Colonia will be adequately cared for according to the sound of its name by visiting merchants of any kind, as long as the merchants and people of individual tribes obey the law laid down in ancient times and honor the city, and conversely the same city leniently presents and guards its rights and anciently valid laws to merchants arriving from wherever. Therefore, at the request and insistence of our aforesaid faithful citizens of Cologne, after previous careful inquiry, as we are accurately informed by the older and wise and trustworthy man through investigation, we caused the said ancient boundaries, together with certain other articles relating to the public benefit, to be clearly expressed in the manner described below. That none of the merchants from Hungary, Bohemia, Poland, Bavaria, Swabia, Saxony, Thuringia, Hesse, and any other possible eastern region, who come to the Rhine with any goods, penetrate beyond the city of Cologne, except in the interest of a pilgrimage. That also no Flemish or Brabant or any other from beyond the Meuse or other regions down the Rhine, according to the old and rightly to be followed custom, with the intention of trading, shall penetrate further than Cologne, and not to the other bank of the Rhine, nor up the Rhine further than the village of Rodenkirchen. Similarly, none of the merchants from the higher regions outside the diocese of Cologne will further than the lower tower of the city of Cologne, or perhaps beyond the village called Riel, for the purpose of trading. However, any of these merchants who are caught by any citizens of Cologne not acting or having acted accordingly or in the opposite direction can be arrested by the same citizen with impunity and legally and punished in the traditional manner, which is called Hansen in the vernacular. The people of Cologne, so this is now me talking, not the document. The people of Cologne are also allowed to exercise justice independently, and the text now continues. This is usually done in such a way that the citizens of Cologne tie up the merchant caught by him or them in such an offence with a reed or rushes or any similar rope. If the merchant tries to untie or break this cord against the will of the citizen, he shall for such an offence come under the control of the citizen, who shall hold him fast and bind him in the aforementioned manner, both with his person and his property. And if it should be necessary, because of the vehemence of the resistance, we, the archbishop, and our successors, or any judge of the place, shall execute it at the request or complaint of the same citizen of Cologne, so that it shall be done in the manner mentioned. Likewise, no foreign merchant, wherever he may come from, may stay in the city of Cologne for more than 6 consecutive weeks for the purpose of buying or selling. And each merchant shall not be permitted to do this more than 3 times in each year with the usual and customary intervals. And furthermore, no merchant may do through his business partner or his messenger or through any other person whatsoever what he is not permitted to do so personally in this respect, excluding any fraud or deceit. End quote. So, how about that dark medieval time where nothing was really written down or controlled? After that, the document goes on into much more detail about the sale or prohibition of several goods and to what extent, but let's skip that. That was already long enough. Well, you might think, that's nice. Cologne had the staple right, but what's so special about it? Cologne was not the only place where a staple right was granted in the Middle Ages, because the staple right existed in many places and early modern times. There are several reasons why Cologne was able to implement the staple right more effectively than anyone else and became extremely rich as a result. Cologne is the largest city in the empire north of the Alps in what is now Germany in the Middle Ages. As a long-distance trader, you don't want to mess things up with such a trading partner who had the best relations in the known world at that time. Another thing is Cologne's location on the Rhine. In the Middle Ages, and even today, the Rhine is the waterway which most goods are transported by ship. Until there were lorries and well-developed roads, the waterway was the most effective way of transporting many goods at once at good speed from ancient times. As I said, the Rhine is not just a waterway, but the waterway between Northern Europe and Italy, linking numerous regions in Europe along the way. You pass Cologne on the Rhine, one way or the other, and the staple right was waiting there. You couldn't get past it. The location on the Rhine, the city's location on the Rhine, is a double argument here. Cologne simply benefited immensely from the hydrographic conditions of the Rhine at this point. North of the city, the Rhine River was deeper and heavier, and above all, more bulbous ships, so-called Dutchmen, which were also sometimes seaworthy, could navigate here. South of Cologne, however, the navigation channel of the river became less deep. This meant that from here towards southern Germany and Italy, ships could only sail with shallower hulls and less cargo. They were also not seaworthy, so-called Oberländers. I will put pictures of them on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. In other words, Cologne was the ideal harbor to carry out the necessary hydrographic reloading of ships. These points, Cologne as the largest city in medieval Germany, its location on the waterway of Europe, and the natural conditions ensured that the right of staple would be realized so well by Cologne, and the city, as I said before, became very rich as a result. Of course, some long-distance traders traveling through try to circumvent Cologne's staple right. They usually try to travel on the right bank of the Rhine, so on the opposite side of the river from Cologne, deep through the territory of the Counts of Berg, for example. Today's Cologne district of Zündorf, which was only incorporated into Cologne in 1975, and its defense tower there still bear witness to this today, that people landed there and tried to circumvent the staple right of Cologne. Shortly before Cologne on the right bank of the Rhine, everything had to be loaded onto carts and painstakingly transported overland past Deutz and Cologne in particular. But woe betide you if you got caught. You have already read it in the original text of the staple right Anyone caught by the people of Cologne circumventing the staple right would be severely punished, loss of all goods and penalties of honor. 1259 was therefore a fateful year in Cologne. The archbishop disempowered the previous bourgeois patrician elite and Konrad von Hochstein granted Cologne the right of staple. But haven't we learned that the patrician families of Cologne had it all, both economically and militarily? That's right. They did not accept their disempowerment without resistance. They were taken by surprise in 1259, yes. In 1260, however, some of them struck back. For example, at Easter 1261, violence is actually forbidden during public holidays, but so be it. The patrician Bruno Hardefust at the top, whose family had been expelled from the College of Magistrates, and several other patrician families dared to revolt in the city. A street battle broke out with butchers who belonged to Konrad's so-called Alliance of Discontent. The street battle ended without a clear winner, but in the end, however, 16 Cologne citizens were dead. The College of Magistrates, now loyal to the archbishop and the archbishop himself, take merciless advantage of the incident to once again take actions against the old patrician families. The result was a fine of 600 marks, and they had to beg barefoot for mercy in the archbishop's palace. And 4 weeks later, another uprising failed by the patricians. The archbishop and his allies of discontent were just too powerful. The leaders of the second uprising are skillfully arrested in the archbishop's palace. Konrad had 20 of them imprisoned in castles in the surrounding countryside and placed under house arrest. Now the archbishop's almost complete rule over Cologne was finally established. One could put forward a thesis. What Archbishop Engelbert I had tried but failed to achieve at the beginning of the 13th century and was even murdered in the end for his quest for power, his successor Konrad von Hochstein had achieved. He was building a new Cologne cathedral, what Engelbert had in mind, and he had put down the power of the patrician families in Cologne as well. Cologne was once again firmly in the hands of the Cologne Church. So was it now all over? No patrician families ruling the city anymore? Well, not quite. Konrad von Hochstaden was now over 60 years old. He himself had ruled Cologne for almost a quarter of a century. 2 years after his revolution from above, on 18th September 1261, Konrad von Hochstaden died after ruling Cologne for 23 years. And even if the archbishop was a permanent institution, the Middle Ages were a time of personal relationships, and with Konrad's death, the cards in the city were reshuffled. Oh, that's a word. But no archbishop of Cologne was to become as powerful as Konrad again. And the patrician families of Cologne were to be given their chance again. The omnipotence of the archbishops of Cologne was to be short-lived in the 13th century. Konrad von Hochstaden left a lasting mark on Cologne both in architecture and in the memory of the city's inhabitants. His tomb is located in Cologne Cathedral in St. John's Chapel in the Choir Gallery. You can't really miss him when you are there. Incidentally, Queen Richeza is also buried in the same chapel, and we once featured her prominently in an episode. Konrad von Hochstaden was also honored in more recent times. For example, a statue was dedicated to him on Cologne's historical town hall tower, alongside many other historical figures who have left their mark on our city. However, the medieval plinth on which Konrad's statue from 1991 stands is remarkable. The plinth shows a grotesque figure performing an obscene gesture. How can I say this in this podcast? He's doing a kind of auto fellatio. However, the fact that he is doing this, that the plinth is located right next to Konrad underneath, is pure coincidence. Before the Second World War, there were already statues of saints on this spot, which emphasized the original religious character of the square. These figures were lost in the bombing of World War II, however, the plinths remained at the building. It was only after the war that the plinth was reused with today's unexpected depiction, which led to the curious combination with Konrad's statue. The beautiful mosaics that characterized the floor of Cologne Cathedral in the choir were created at the end of the 19th century. In addition to well-known personalities such as Hildebold, Conrad von Hochstein is also depicted in a mosaic in front of the axial chapel, together with a floor plan of the cathedral in his hand. Let's leave it for today. Many thanks this time to Sylvia, Norbert, Christian, Antje, Vero Küche, Anke and Steven for your tips via PayPal. Thanks to Heiko for your now long-term support of this podcast via patreon.com. As always, I used Hugo Stehkämper and Karl Dietmar, Köln im Hochmittelalter, so Cologne in the High Middle Ages. Furthermore, Manfred Grotes, Köln im 13. Jahrhundert, Cologne in the 13th century. Gunther Hirschfelder and Anja Ostrowitzki with the analysis and translation of the text of the Kölner Stapelrechte, Cologne Stapelrechte in Quellen zur Geschichte der Stadt Köln, Volume 1. So, sources about Cologne's history, Volume 1. And Bedeutende Bischöfe von Köln im historischen Kontext, Volume 3. So, important are bishops of Cologne concerning their historical context, Volume 3. I think next time we should take another look at certain aspects of the city in the middle of the 13th century. The last few episodes were very eventful and we still have some catching up to do before we get into the hot phase towards all the battles and wars that will shake not only Cologne, but also the northwest of the empire in the end. Recommend me further to others, rate the podcast in your favorite podcast app and auf Wiedersehen.